Comic-Con, the annual pop culture convention, begins today in San Diego. 125,000 people are expected to swarm the city, some in costume, to check out the latest comic books, movies, TV shows, and comedy. Comic-Con comedy. Say that five times fast as you listen to NPR's Nina Gregory.
Amongst the caped crusaders and masked men, there are those who come to Comic-Con not to don their alter egos, but to find the funny. Not funny pages, but funny people. Tucked away in the little rooms of the San Diego Convention Center, fans seek out panels and performances from their favorite comedians. Keith Phipps is the editor of the entertainment paper, The AV Club. He explains what kind of comedy works at Comic-Con.
For the last few years, it's kind of anything that can stir a cultish following has a home at Comic-Con. And certainly comedy is no stranger to cult followings from Monty Python on up.
One show that fits that cult comedy niche is Children's Hospital. It's a parody of hospital dramas on Cartoon Network's Adult Swim.
It takes more than the healing power of laughter to perform a successful operation.
Yeah, sometimes it takes actual medical procedure.
Sometimes.
Rob Corddry is the show's creator and star. He talks about why he goes to Comic-Con.
I have to be honest about it. I guess my involvement in Comic-Con is more parasitic than anything. Like, I am going there, you know, A, to have fun, and B, to, yeah, hopefully get more viewers for my show.
Corddry will be on a panel where fans can ask him questions. And this is part of the draw. Fans get to see sneak peeks and exclusive performances. They get to connect with the people who make and star in these shows. And they get to meet other fans. Again, Keith Phipps.
There's sort of nothing like sharing space with people who have your same obsessions. And whether that's, you know, comic books or Children's Hospital, Comic-Con seems to find room for everyone.
Well, not everyone. Comedian Kurt Metzger is on Ugly Americans. That's an animated comedy horror series on Comedy Central. Metzger plays an unemployed and undead zombie roommate. Despite this pedigree, he says fans at Comic-Con can be tough critics.
There's a certain kind of nerd that's like a real Robespierre type, you know, where they start out like kind of effete and weak seeming, but then once they have a little bit of power, they're just vicious. You know, it just bugs me. I mean, I thought we were all nerds and we're not like that.
Oh, but in the modern day French Revolution, that is the blogosphere, these nerds do have the power to behead. And of course, leave it to the comedians to then reject Comic-Con.
Everything we try to do is a rejection of everything else. So we can't just say, oh, well, we finally found our little home at Comic-Con. We have to find our home at Comic-Con and then reject it.
That's Tim Heidecker. He and Eric Wareheim are the stars of the Adult Swim show, Tim and Eric Awesome Show, Great Job. Yes, that's the show's actual title. And despite the fact that its surrealistic style of comedy is practically tailor-made to suit the discriminating tastes of Comic-Con goers, Tim and Eric rejected Comic-Con. They took up residence at a nearby park where they staged their own makeshift convention, AwesomeCon. And their loyal fans followed. And that's a great thing about Comic-Con. The pleasure is in finding the funny, whether in a small room or a park down the street. Nina Gregory, NPR News.
The federal government says whitebark pines face an imminent risk of extinction. The trees are critical to the high mountain ecosystems in Yellowstone National Park and across the Northern Rockies. A ravenous beetle, a fungus, and climate change are largely to blame. But as NPR's Elizabeth Shogren reports, the government says it can't afford to put them on the endangered species list.
Scientist Jesse Logan was the first one to predict that global warming would allow a major outbreak of mountain pine beetles in whitebarks. But last week, when he hiked near the northwest corner of Yellowstone, he was astounded. Where he expected to find green trees mixed in with dead ones, every mature tree was a dead gray skeleton.
You'd think I'd get used to it, but it's always a shock when you go into these beautiful, vibrant forests that are no more.
Logan says then he noticed something that raised his hopes.
We saw from a distance this really nice little grove of white bark that are almost cone-bearing age, and, oh, that's cool. Here's the future forest.
But when he reached them, he found their branches swollen with the telltale sores of white pine blister rust. That disease will prevent those young trees from ever bearing cones and eventually kill them. These combined threats, blister rust and mountain pine beetle, persuaded federal biologist Amy Nicholas that whitebark pine qualify for endangered species list protection.
Both of these threats act to severely decrease seed cone production. When there's no seeds left, you're going to lose your species.
Do you think it's a foregone conclusion that this tree will go extinct?
Yeah, I do. Or at the very least, there might still be some trees scattered here and there and left on the landscape, but the tree is functionally probably going to be extinct.
But instead of putting whitebarks on the endangered species list, her agency added them to a list of candidate species. Nicholas says the Federal Fish and Wildlife Service doesn't have the money or resources to protect the trees. Experts say what's so tragic about the tree's fate is they literally created the habitat in the high mountains, and they provide lots of services to nature and people. They grow at high altitudes where no other trees can survive. Their nutritious seeds feed grizzly bears and lots of other animals. And shade from their broad canopies retains the snow in the mountains longer, keeping streams running fuller and cooler in the summer.
So that impacts everything. That impacts us, it impacts agriculture, it impacts fisheries.
University of Montana forest pathologist Diana Six says the whitebark die-off shows how climate change can set off chain reactions that radically alter ecosystems. The weather on the high mountains where whitebark grow used to be too frigid for mountain pine beetles, but warming temperatures have allowed an outbreak to reach epic scale.
It's hard to see something so spectacular and so important decline. It really hits you right to your core.
Six says in the high elevations of Yellowstone and Grand Teton, what she calls ghost forests, the gray skeletons of whitebarks, will stand for a century or more to remind visitors of the vibrant habitat that once was. Elizabeth Shogren, NPR News.
Commentator Andrei Cădrescu has been reading some biography this summer, and he is not happy.
I picked up a biography of Kay Boyle by John Mellon. I met Kay in San Francisco in the 70s, a formidable grande dame with a regal presence and a radical temperament. Part of the gang of American expatriates in Paris in the 1920s that included Gertrude Stein and Ernest Hemingway, she'd written novels, stories, and journalism, and done two stints in jail for civil disobedience. I should have known when I started reading her biography that I was in for a nightmare. The biographies of writers are often hostile because biographers bring their own frustrated lives into play under the cover of research. It was fascinating, in a cringing sort of way, to learn all the ways in which Kay Boyle failed her children and her husbands. But at some point I realized that I was no longer reading Kay Boyle's biography, but the autobiography of the biographer, who was now using her subject to settle her own scores. She had plenty of fuel for this retrospective autodafé. Needing money, Kay Boyle had occasionally dumbed down her talent to write for popular magazines, and she'd sold her letters to universities, believing, like many writers do now, that therein lies vindication, not indictment. In the 19th century, when official archives for personal papers barely existed, many writers had the good sense to burn their private papers. These days, the biographies of writers sell better than the writer's work. It seems that readers prefer the simpler story of Schadenfreude to the scary operations of art. In the culture of instant celebrity, the biographical enterprise is in full swing. A huge market in biographies and biopics feeds a growing appetite that needs subjects so badly the subject is often born at the same time as his or her biography. Writers who rate zero on the celebrity scale now were the starter fuel for this bonfire of nastiness. The only thing missing from the merciless and entertaining marshalling of biographical facts on Kay Boyle is life. Kay consumed herself and one now sees quite a few others in an effort to live a socially useful life. The same facts that gave life to her work and her battles are here used against her. If a biographer calls, don't answer the door.
Andrei Kudrescu's latest book is Whatever Gets You Through the Night, a story of Scheherazade and the Arabian entertainments.
You're listening to NPR.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, Detroit's hard times are well known. Troubles in the auto industry, bare-to-the-bone budgets, corruption scandals involving top city officials. But despite all that, it turns out that young professionals and creative types are moving back to the Motor City in numbers that matter. We'll tell you more about that in a few minutes. But first, if you follow sports, especially golf, you've probably heard of Rory McIlroy. He topped the world amateur golf rankings for a week at the tender age of 17. And then last month, at the age of 22, he went on to become the youngest winner of the U.S. Open since Bobby Jones in 1923. Well, there is another young golfer that we think you want to know about, and she could be the next Tiger Woods. We're talking about 17-year-old Mariah Stackhouse. She's competed in nearly 200 golf tournaments. She has won half of them and scored in the top 10 in nearly all of them. She's also the youngest African-American to qualify for U.S. Women's Open that wrapped up earlier this month. And now she's swinging her clubs at the U.S. Girls Junior Amateur Championship in Chicago that finishes up this weekend. We wanted to talk to her about how she's made it this far, so we caught up with her before she flew to the tournament. Thanks so much for taking the time to talk with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
So how did the golf bug bite you?
I was a daddy's girl when I was little, and he used to go to the course some evenings, and he would take me along with him. And about when I was 2 years old, he cut down a set of clubs for me, and I began to practice alongside him, and he never stopped taking me, and I guess I developed a liking for the game, and I kept practicing, and here I am now.
What is it that you like about the sport?
It's different than a lot of sports because I can converse with my competitors and compete at the same time, whereas in sports like basketball or soccer, it's action, and you can't really get to know the people that you're playing with because there's no time for talking and getting to know someone. But when you're on the golf course, you can be serious, but you can be relaxed at the same time and just kind of get to know the people that you're playing with. And I think it's great because it's an open sport. Anybody can play golf who really wants to.
How do you feel about some of the words that I just used to describe you, for example? First of all, the youngest to do this or that, the youngest African-American, the first African-American since this or that. How does all that strike you?
When people, you know, have titles like that for me, it's just, you know, a way to show me that maybe what I'm doing is working and I'm improving and that's what people see me as, but I don't see myself as those things.
The next Tiger Woods or the next possible Tiger Woods comparison, is that a burden or is that kind of fun or how does that strike you?
Anyone who would say the next Tiger Woods is somebody that doesn't really play golf, because if you know golf very well, at 17 years old, Tiger had won some amazing tournaments and I've done well in quite a few, but I haven't made any of the accomplishments that he's made in terms of the caliber tournaments that I've won as, let's say, the U.S. Junior or the U.S. Amateur, and he had done those things. So I think it's just a comparison made based on the fact that we are both young African-Americans in a sport that there are not many of us out here playing. So I think that's where that statement originates from, but it's definitely not something that I'll dwell too much on because there are significant differences between the two of us.
Spoken like a person who's on her way to Stanford. Where Tiger Woods also studied for a minute before he went to go pro. I just ask one more question before we get back to golf about the racial aspect of it, though, because you do know that there are golf courses that were restrictive, where they specifically did not allow African-Americans or Jews, for that matter, to be members, let alone to play. There are still, of course, there's the whole issue around Augusta National doesn't allow women as members. You know, this was something that Tiger talked about early in his career and stopped talking about. I mean, for example, in his first ad for American Express, he talked about the fact that, you know, opportunities had been denied because of the color of his skin or that he would not have been able to have some of these opportunities earlier in the life of the sport. Do you even think about that anymore? Is that even part of your consciousness?
I don't see much of that anymore. Even if there are people out here who are prejudiced, they do their best to hide it. And I've never really had any experiences with treatment that was not as well as my competitors due to race, or at least I'm not aware of it. And my dad has always been around me all the times that I'm on the golf course, and he was pretty protective of me at a young age. And I think now I know how to handle certain situations, and I present myself and I try to be a nice young lady and just not ever be in a situation or not place myself in a situation that I don't have to be in.
You know, as we are talking, the Women's World Cup in soccer has just been played, and there was a lot of excitement about this, obviously, in this country when, you know, because the Americans were mm-hmm. in the final, and that's fine. But there have been struggles on the women's side of some of these sports. Well, for example, on the one hand, like in tennis, the purses have become, the winnings have equalized over time. But on the mm-hmm. women's side of your sport, they have not. In fact, the tour has been curtailed at some point because, you know, the sponsorships just haven't been there, the television ratings have not been as large and so forth. Do you feel in any way as a girl that the playing field is level for you, that you can have as much opportunity in sport because of your gender?
There is a lot more available to men who play professional golf than there are women. But I think that as the years go along, we'll see more progression on the LPGA Tour. Every sport has setbacks. And I think that they're trying to figure out ways to get new sponsorships for the tour, and we'll see improvement. I don't think I'll be denied anything, but that's another reason that I'm going to college, and I wanted to go to the best one possible, because you don't know, you know, where a sport can take you, so I want to make sure that I have an education behind me in case things don't work out.
What do you plan to study at Stanford?
It's going to be a business-related major, and I also have some interests in medicine, so I'll minor in a science. But maybe when I get there, my interests will change. But right now, it's business and medicine are my interests.
And possibly a career in diplomacy, from what I hear from these answers. Perhaps your former Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, who's also at Stanford, might have some thoughts on that if she gets her hands on you, from what I hear. And finally, do you have any tips for us amateurs?
All I have to say is make sure that you're having fun, because golf can be very frustrating at times if you put too much pressure on yourself. You have to be patient on the golf course. So just have fun. It's going to take you a while to develop skills and to begin to hit the ball with authority. And if you expect to step out there and show out the first time you get on the course, then I don't think golf is your sport.
Okay. Mariah Stackhouse is the youngest African-American qualifier for a U.S. Women's Open. She's also a player representative for the American Junior Golf Association, and she's headed off to Stanford in the fall of 2012. Mariah, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Michelle. It's my pleasure.
Corporations across the board are enjoying huge profits, and the stock market is up about 9% lately. In contrast, unemployment rates are higher than at the beginning of this year. To talk more about what seems like a disconnect to many people, we called David Wessel. He's economics editor of the Wall Street Journal and a regular guest here on Morning Edition. David, welcome back.
Good morning, Steve.
Okay, when we say profits are up, how much? How well are companies doing?
A lot. We're beginning to get the second quarter profits. You know, some companies aren't doing well. Some winners, like Goldman Sachs, had a bad quarter. But the season is off to an amazingly strong start. Drug company Abbott Labs up 50%, they said yesterday. United Technologies, which make elevators and aircraft engines, up 19%. Harley-Davidson said motorcycle sales are up. Their earnings more than doubled. There's an economic commentator, Ed Yardeni, who does a daily tally. And as of last night, he says that of the 100 companies in the S&P 500 who've reported so far, their profits are up nearly 12% on average over last year.
I'm trying to figure that out. I mean, if the construction industry is lousy, you've got an elevator company making profits, you've got people that aren't spending a lot of money, and yet Harley-Davidson has more profits on motorcycles. What's going on there?
Well, people are buying motorcycles. The sales of motorcycles rose in the United States for the first time in more than 4 years.
Hmm.
But the reason the bottom lines are getting fatter is, one, these big companies are getting a lot more of their business from overseas now. Many big companies, a typical big company, sells more than half its stuff somewhere else. And particularly in China and other emerging markets, business is really, really good. But another reason is that the companies are pursuing relentless cost cutting, getting more out of each hour of work. So even little increases in sales mean really big profits.
Increase in productivity, that's what you're talking about here.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, how much more can companies really get out of their workforces?
Well, that's a good question. You'd think that eventually they'd have to add workers or make the workers they have work longer hours. But people have been saying that's going to happen any day now for about 2 years. In all, we lost more than 8 million jobs in the recession. We've only got 2 million back so far. And so far this year, we've added 120,000 a month. So you can see how long it would take to get back to full employment. And we see now, we have a story on the front page of the Wall Street Journal today, that there's a new round of layoffs. It's not only that companies aren't hiring, some of them are actually cutting their workforces again. I think there are a couple of reasons. One is they're simply not confident that there's demand for their product. There's a lot of uncertainty, not only about the economy, but about government policy. And then many of them are still finding ways to increase productivity, pushing people to work harder, some using new technology, some with outsourcing, and we don't seem to be at the end of that string yet.
David, we just got about 10 seconds here. Are companies at least being more generous with the employees they've got?
No. Wages are not going up. The typical full-time man made $828 a week in the second quarter. Adjusted for inflation, that's less than in 2002.
Wow. Okay, David, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
That's David Wessel, economics editor of the Wall Street Journal.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. The heat is oppressive across the country, and for Pittsburgh Pirate fans, most summers are oppressive, but not this one. This week, the Pirates moved into first place of the National League Central Division. They haven't been in first place this late in the season in 14 years, and Pittsburgh finally is buzzing about the Bucs.
Terry McFerrin. I've been a lifelong Pirate fan. This is just the most exciting thing going for Pittsburgh right now. They're just doing so well. I listen to them every day, and I talk to my daughter about them every day. Everyone in my family is really excited.
Alex Stanzione from Pittsburgh, here for a long time, 20 plus years now. I'm in my mid-20s, and so I remember the last time the Pirates winning in 92 when I was 6 and 7 years old. They've been just so irrelevant and basically a quad A minor league baseball team. And so it's nice to finally have a team that's gained respectability amongst their peers in the major leagues and amongst the fans here in America for them to be considered much a contender. It's been awesome.
But will this enthusiasm last? Well, joining me to talk about this is Jerry Micco. He's a sports editor for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Robert. It's a pleasure to be on.
And before we get to the good news about this year and how long the Pirates can keep it up, tell us about how bad the team has been for the past several years.
Well, Robert, it's been 18 years since they've had a winning season in Pittsburgh. So Pittsburgh fans here have gotten used to bad baseball over time, although they've never liked it. And a lot of that's come out in certain ways. They haven't supported the team as well as they maybe would have had they won, certainly. And the ownership has taken it on the chin, and rightfully so, I think, for not spending a lot of money. But they have a plan now, and it looks like it's starting to come to fruition. And we'll see how far this goes. But certainly the people in Pittsburgh this summer have supported this ball club.
Well, what's so different about the team? What happened that turned the Pirates into a winning ball club this season?
They hired Clint Hurdle in the offseason. As you might remember, Hurdle a few years ago took the Colorado Rockies to the World Series, lost to the Red Sox. But he's infused such an enthusiasm into the team. You have that. Plus, I think you have some players who are maturing into better players. Neil Walker, who's in his second year, is doing very well. Andrew McCutchen is kind of reaching the potential they thought he would. And I think you've got enough good pitching, and they've managed in a division that's fairly weak to do very well, and the people in Pittsburgh have just been loved every minute of it. So a lot of factors conspired, I think, to bring these guys where they are right now.
Jerry, in this drought era, what I'll politely refer to as the post-Clemente, post-Stargell era of the Pittsburgh Pirates, the football team, the Steelers, have been great in many seasons. The hockey team, the Penguins, have been great in many years. Are the Pirates that other team in town that people don't really think about that much, or have they remained large in the hearts of the people of Pittsburgh?
I think in the hearts of the people of Pittsburgh, they've remained large, but they're a very discouraged bunch. 18 years will do that to you. The people in Pittsburgh, though, because of the history of the Pirates and the rich history of baseball here, still supported them. Now, not like they would have had they won, but nonetheless, they still supported them. And I think it's more of a reward for those fans that the team is now put together is a good team, and they're showing up to show their appreciation for that.
Is this team good enough to end up the season in first place, to be in the postseason, maybe to make it to the World Series?
I think it's going to be a stretch for them to get into the postseason. Their next 40 games, 32 of them are against teams with 500 record or better. I think they have a real shot to win, to break the 18-year losing streak and win 82 or 83 or even 85 games. I don't know if they can do that or not. I don't know if they're quite ready yet to get that far, but I think they can contend all the way through.
Well, Jerry, thanks for talking with us.
Sure, Robert. My pleasure.
Jerry Mickle, who is sports editor for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette.